Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
Welcome to Right On Radio. I'm Kirk Klocke, your host today, and my guest today is Barbara Powell, author of Finding Leadville, My Story to a Hallowed 100-Mile Finish Line. You're listening to 90.3 KFAI FM in the Twin Cities and streaming online. I am so glad to welcome Barbara Powell. Barbara, welcome. Tell us a little bit about how this project started, and first of all, where are you from?
Yeah, it's so good to be here, Kirk. How cool is it to be able to chat about my book a bit?
It is.
But, I live here in South Minneapolis, and I'm actually originally from Western Massachusetts. I grew up as a middle child in a family of 12, where we grew up without television. We grew up without, you know, internet access.
Wow.
We really were just like running amok outside or having our noses in a book or some sort of creative project.
That is like the old school upbringing of, what do they call them, turnkey kids, which are, it sounds like a very Gen X upbringing.
Very much, but no Instagram, right, to account for it.
Yeah, and this was the early 90s-ish, late 80s, early 90s, and that's pretty much what people did, because I'm in the same age range, and we didn't get overwhelmed with video games and computers until later, most of us. But it sounds like you had an extra, was this a rural setting?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was born in 88, so what, that makes me 37. But I grew up in Western Massachusetts. I was about like 90 minutes outside of Boston. It was like a dead end street. There was a golf course on one side of that dead end street and an Air Force base actually on the other. And then in our backyard, we just had access to a huge field, acres of woods right behind that. So a lot of time just running around with my best friends, my siblings, and in the trees. So really from a young age, building this very like strong, loving relationship with nature. Nature's always felt like, yeah, a big part of me, prompting me to want to run ultra marathons ultimately, and then ultimately, you know, wanting to write a book about what is that even like to get immersed in the trees for that long of a period of time.
And we had talked in our pre-interview about the theme of endurance and how important that is in both your life, the book, the ultra marathon, but also in our community right now.
Yeah.
We couldn't really go further without giving pause to the level of suffering and triumph and endurance that's happening here in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
We're sitting in your home office that was just blocks from where George Floyd died a few years ago, and then more recently where Renee Macklin Good was shot and killed by ICE, and just a couple miles from where Alex Preddy, a VA nurse, was also shot and killed by ICE.
Yeah.
That's the level and the tone that our community is facing right now. What have you observed in your neighborhood as far as that goes? Has it been a really strange time for you to go through this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a Minnesotan, Minneapolis resident now for a decade, a little bit over that. And enough time being here where I really truly feel like I can wear that tag of Minnesotan over that tag of Massachusetts kid, right, growing up. And I find that living in South Minneapolis right now with this background of endurance, right, being an endurance runner, of being a writer and having such a deep relationship with words and language, putting imagery and picture to what is actually happening and how humans are feeling, I find myself really compelled to take notice, to be a watchful eye. I know I'm very far from alone in that. So many of us, this is what we are doing right now. We're being a watchful eye for the nation. Alex himself, right, being a watchful eye with his phone till his very last moments. And so giving this opportunity to be here in South Minneapolis, yes, it's harrowing, truly, to be here. And there's this aspect of being in the long haul, surrounded by and equipped with relationships and neighborly connection that really, I mean, seriously, like that is the very thing that is propelling and moving us through this time right now.
I think people were really even surprised themselves at how neighborly they already were, even though they might not have met their neighbors. I'm just hearing about all of these neighborhood signal chats and different ways people are making sure that vulnerable folks have resources, everything from food, clothing, to even rent assistance. I think that's just amazing that along that theme of endurance, we are enduring as a community. And that said, do you have any poetry from this book that you might like to read along that theme? No pressure or anything.
But, yeah. Well, just for our listeners, so you know, the book itself, it's a collection of both story and poetry that really does, again, it chronicles my journey throughout the Leadville 100, this race that takes place at 10,000 feet altitude, you know, throughout the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And there were different things that prompted me, you know, to run that race and get to the finish line. But ultimately, the major fuel, the thing that actually really assisted me through those 100 miles were the people. Were the individuals who ran alongside me, were actually racing with me, were the pacers, the people who ran with me, you know, in the middle of the night to get me to the finish line. And folks at aid stations, you know, to support and take care of all of the runners.
And we'll get into a little more about the process of the run itself. But I thought that opening up with a little sample of your writing, poetry, if you have it.
I do.
And in your own voice, which that's really cool that we're able to meet in person today and do this. So let's see what we have here.
This poem is called Step at a Time. All I need to do is take a single step, and it usually turns into two. Before I know it, I've stepped into a new way of being, now mighty and true. It no longer feels scary, it's just something I do. So I'll step again as it turns into two. And I'll be many more steps toward another thing, mighty and new.
Oh, it's too soon to give me goosebumps.
Bring on the goosebumps.
Oh, wait, I'm supposed to be objective here. Okay. So let's rewind a little bit. And I don't want to give away too much of the book. But you do talk about your upbringing, which you've given us a little bit of that already with you came from a really big family. And you're one of the middle children.
Yeah.
Now adult children. How does being from a big family in a rural area play into what would later become your drive to do one of the hardest races in the country? Because as if 100 miles isn't enough, we're going to just make it at altitude. Which is, you know, half the air that we have here in Minnesota.
I mean, well, growing up in such a big family, so the way that the breakdown was, there were seven of us girls, or there are seven of us girls and five boys. And four of those boys were older brothers of mine. And I always found myself, I don't know, really aware, even at an early age, of how differently the girls in my family and the boys in my family were able to move through life. And by that, I mean, You know, my family was strictly Catholic, quite conservative. And there was this air that the boys could be brave, the boys could take chances, the boys could get dirty, the boys could swear and spit and do no wrong. But there was this ongoing message of the girls had to be a lady. You know, like keep your legs crossed, keep your back straight, wear the dress down to your ankles at church, stay covered up, don't tease the boys. There was a lot of this, whether it was sometimes blatantly said or just kind of really sneaky undertone, a lot of that present in my upbringing.
This sounds really old school, like what my sure. parents even described with their Catholic school upbringing in the, you know, late 50s, early 60s. So it almost sounds like you were in this cultural bubble that where those values really lasted longer than they might have in bigger cities.
There's, you know, my parents really were choiceful about purchasing a piece of farmland, you know, out in Granby, which is a small town, Western Massachusetts, to really, you know, ensure that us kids could have this upbringing that was preserved, that was, deeply connected to their values and how they viewed the world, gave us almost like, bubbled like space and protection from a lot of what was happening in the world. Yeah.
And as you went from childhood to adolescence, you write in the book about finding out that you're pretty naturally good at running and you like it.
Yeah, who'd have thought?
And, you know, not everybody is. I certainly am not. And tell us about just a little bit about what running was like in high school, and then I presume you did some running in college, too.
Oh, yeah. So, again, because of all of us siblings, there wasn't a lot of money to go around, and one of the cheapest after-school curriculum to take part in was cross-country and track. All you really needed was a pair of hand-me-down shoes, and then you had your track uniform from the school, and you just went and did your thing. And pretty much, I'll say, yeah, all of my siblings partook in, track and cross country during high school. So it was me kind of, you know, following a legacy that was already carved for me. Yeah.
Okay, so some older siblings had already paved the way, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
In a sense. And
so I got to, I you know, went into high school. I started, you know, running on the cross country team. I had a natural talent that just kind of emerged. And that talent was really fostered and celebrated by my coach at the time, Coach John Goda, who really saw in me it's like that little rebel spirit from growing up in a kind of like stifled way in my Catholic family. He honored that rebel spirit in me and really helped me channel that into my running. And I just remember from those early moments as a freshman and sophomore, really feeling as though running gave me this opportunity to really like actively live out a purpose of mine, to really put my body in a place of strength and fortitude where I could go out for long distances and I could spit what I needed to spit and I could
nice.
Heave what I needed to heave and make animal noises and sprint and just really feel this enormous fortitude and strength of my body that I don't know, I necessarily felt like I had full access to until high school. So that was really special. And that, of course, gave me this like truly robust foundation for, you know, running in college and then taking it beyond college into half marathons, road marathons, and then ultimately getting my hands dirty and ultra running.
Do you have any particular memory of a first marathon?
Oh, I do remember my first marathon. I feel as though if any other marathon runners out there, you know your first marathon. I was given an opportunity to run the Houston Marathon. At the time, I was working for Skechers Performance, and they had running shoes that they were, you know, trying to get out there in the world. And so I was doing some marketing and sales rep for them, and I had you know, the opportunity, they gave me a free entry to the Houston Marathon. And up until that point, the farthest I had gone was about like 12 miles. And my about 23-year-old brain said, you know, of course, I can run 26. Why not? I could do that. And so hopped into that marathon. It's a pretty flat marathon if anyone's ever run it. It's kind of got a little, if I remember correctly, a horseshoe shape to it where it's somewhat of an out and back. And I just remember crossing that finish line, tears streaming down my face, just in like total awe that I had just completed something like that.
Did you know how to train at that point, or were, were you just winging it?
I totally winged it, which is so fun. I mean, and it's not, you know, again, sometimes we approach, we have this goal that we are either given, like I was given that goal and decided to fling myself into it. Or maybe we like purposefully select that goal to move toward. We have all kinds of ways of moving toward it. And some folks are maybe a little more particular and building out a structure, you know, getting their mileage correct, moving up to it. And since then I have taken that approach, but first marathon was a little full on fling into it, gonna trust myself type of attitude.
That's so cool. I wonder, though, since we have limited time, let's fast forward to the point where you decide to train for Leadville.
Yeah.
Had you decided to write about it before that? Or at what point did the writing about the running in your life come into the picture?
Good question. So So running and writing have really been companions to me through ever since high school. I have partaken in both on and off. And so there's a deep relationship that I have with both of those hobbies, I guess, or ways of life. And when I decided that I was going to go run the Leadville 100, it was really prompted from a moment of deep grief. I had a friend of mine who I had met through the running community, Ben, who he met me during a trail marathon and actually prompted me and helped me to run my very first ultra.
Okay.
And upon his sudden passing, I was overcome with this despair that, you know, writing and running both really helped me through. And so I'm a consistent journaler. I've always done what's called morning pages, which is 3 pages of free writing every morning, for the most part, every morning.
That's impressive, by the way.
Well, once it becomes part of your way of being, it's actually more difficult to not do it sometimes, just because my life becomes really centered around processing. What was yesterday? What am I looking ahead to today? What am I experiencing? So those morning pages unfolded throughout my journey toward the Leadville 100, throughout that whole summer, in processing what was that summer and what did I just experience. And the book didn't actually really form until, I don't know, about like 6 months later. I just started putting short essays about my experience online and started to get feedback from friends and family about the writing and about my journey. And as soon as all of the essays and poems were online, I collected them all, did some good editing, and it was shaped out to be this book.
Was this something like a Substack or a WordPress or...
Yeah, I wish I had discovered Substack. I don't know. I just joined the Substack game like a month ago.
We'll talk about that before we go.
But this was, I had, at the time, I had, a WordPress website. And then I was, you know, had newsletters attached to that. And, of course, using my Facebook and Instagram pages just to get it out there.
Awesome. As we get into the book, I think it's... I'd like to call out a few different things that were memorable to me. Before we do that, though, just remind us what an ultra marathon is compared to just a marathon. Because I didn't know when I was initially talking to you what makes a marathon an ultra.
Oh, yeah. So an ultra marathon is any distance that's greater than a marathon. So a marathon is 26.2.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be 100 miles.
No.
Just anything.
Dude, if you run 28.
Yeah. I really was struck by the scene of moving out to Colorado, not only because it was going to be a long, hard road, and you knew that, but you had a partner here in Minnesota who you're going to leave behind for several months, mm-hmm. who you might see a couple times, but you kind of had to back burner a relationship, a serious relationship, to do this, and most people just can't do that. Mm-hmm. So how was that?
It was really, it was a mix of being both really difficult to do, to essentially like unweave myself from this tapestry that I had created here in Minneapolis and the partnership that I had with Chris. But it was also the most right decision for me, that I really accredit the ability to do something like that, I really accredit to my relationship to myself around having the ongoing ability to have conversations with myself, to put, you know, in my journaling, to really connect with what really are you feeling, Barbara? What really is your highest self requesting of you? What is your gut, right, saying? What is it prompting you to do? I had really spent years developing that type of relationship. So that when it did get to making this decision to move out to Colorado for 6 months, I was really ready to listen to the call of action that was coming, you know, from inside the house. But like so many of us couples, you know, throughout, you know, 2020, especially those living here in Minneapolis, there were some harrowing events that took place, yes. Right? You know, we had the killing of George Floyd. We had the riots that ensued. We had the call for reformation from our police department. And it created quite a bit of tension and challenge. And so Chris and I got to a place where we really chose together to reset. And knowing that in order to reset for us meant me choosing to move forward on a big goal and desire of mine. I've always wanted to live in the mountains in Colorado. And for him to take the opportunity to get to know himself in the way that I had been doing for myself for so long. So it really ended up being the most special and necessary thing for our relationship.
It sounds like you really made a wise choice and that ultimately you positioned yourselves to know yourselves better.
Yes.
And therefore to have a deeper, richer relationship. That's awesome. Building on the different themes and through lines of the story as we work our way through it, we have that topic of endurance that lasts throughout. Mm. And another one that really strikes me is spirituality.
Mm.
Because you mentioned the religion of your upbringing, and there's a sort of shift where that becomes the spirituality of your adulthood, and those may overlap a little bit, but for you there are very different things, but regardless, there's still some sort of a God in your life.
Hmm.
Whether it's working through the running itself, the people around you supporting you, the nature, the geography, the mm-hmm. beauty, all of that. So that said, would you be willing to read us a little bit more from your book? I found a really nice passage on, I think, page 42, where you talk a little bit about...
Oh, my chat about God.
You chat a little bit about God, and I think that that's a great little spot to add this through line of spirituality and get deeper into that and how that plays a role in your endurance and your... ultimately succeeding in this marathon.
All right, well, I'll give you a snippet here then from page 42. Over the years, I've updated what I believe God to be. My version of God doesn't emerge from a power dynamic. It doesn't live in an organized religion or inside of an ancient script. There's no shame storm that my version ignites, no pressing feeling of less than or subservience. my version of God would slowly rise from the trails that I ran on, in the kindness of coaches who supported me, in teammates who partnered with me, in the winding wood paths, trees bowing in reverence to the majesty of the wind, in the throb of both pleasure and pain in my body. My version of God is quite female, intuitive, supportive, compassionate.
Thank you, Barbara. If you're just joining us, that was author Barbara Powell reading from her book, Finding Leadville, My Story to a Hallowed 100-Mile Finish Line.
Programming is supported by Mutual Management Company. Mutual Management offers housing in Riverside Homes, a collection of vintage, low-density properties in the heart of the Riverside neighborhood. These homes feature unique layouts, strong connections to outdoor spaces, and the opportunity to build community within this vibrant area. Since 1980, Riverside Homes has helped preserve the character of this critical neighborhood. Learn more or explore available housing by contacting Mutual Management, MutualMGMTCompany.com, or by calling 612-333-9164. Make Riverside Homes your next home.
This is 90.3 KFAI FM in the Twin Cities and streaming online on the KFAI Fresh Air Radio app. I'm Kirk Klocke, your host, and we are talking about Barbara's book, not only the writing of it, but the process that went into the running and the writing, which kind of mirrored each other. Barbara talked earlier in the hour about writing morning pages and writing poetry and writing prose and putting it out there for family to look at, and family and friends gave feedback, and ultimately you got this idea, hey, I think this could all tie together and mm-hmm. be a book project. Mm-hmm. Was that overwhelming to think of the idea of writing a book while training for this enormous thing? Or did it actually, in a way, was it kind of a break from the training? How did that work?
Yeah, well, the book came together during some very quiet, cold Minnesotan winter moments. So those are the moments in my life, in my training seasons, that are a little bit more quiet. I run less mileage. But I still have a call for some sort of finish line to move toward. And so, you know, the chips just really fell into place of taking what I had already created and putting it together in a very thoughtful, deliberate way in order to create, yeah, something that I could just actually hold in my two hands, something I could gift to people, something that I could you know, leave as a tangible thing, not just an online print on the screen.
Yeah, that's so cool. And you followed through with it. And that's one of the things that I've always been impressed with by your work, is that you decide to do something and you really do it. Mm-hmm. And that inspires me to get going on my own writing.
Oh, hell yeah. That's what we kind of got to do. We collect gems from other writers, artists, creatives. And sometimes there's just a message or a way of being that really just lands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had one of my favorite professors in college told us that we should actually try to imitate the style and the voice of a writer that we really admire and like, and that our failure to perfectly do so will actually, our own voice will emerge.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And I've always found that a really, really interesting bit of advice. Mm. Now, without giving away too much from the book, tell us a little bit about the lead up to race day and your living conditions in Colorado. I'm just looking at the copy of the book right now that has this abstract cabin, woodsy kind of a timber frame cabin with abstract mountain peaks and a moon. Shout out to whoever did the book art for your
Barbara Powell. So this is the pleasure of self-publishing. So I designed the book cover myself, and everything between the front and back cover is all mine.
Wow. Well, I think we're going to save self-publishing and that whole process as a part two of this interview, because that's its own hour of talk.
Sure is.
But it is noteworthy that not only did you finish the book while training and then running the Ultra 100, you did it all yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And
quite proud of that.
It looks very nice. It's a very sharp volume. For those of you who might be interested in, and it's obtainable on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you can contact Barbara directly on her Instagram, which is...
It's Barbara Powell Coach on Instagram, and then there's also my Substack that you can find my work on.
Cool.
But yeah, the journey, my Colorado journey, even leading up to the start line. So when I got into my 2001 rusty dusty Subaru and drove through, you know, from Minnesota through Nebraska, straight up Hoosiers Pass to a little cabin that I had acquired that I would be staying in all summer. And that cabin happened to be at just shy of 12,000 feet altitude. So every night when I laid down my head to sleep, I was sleeping at about 11,500 feet or so.
Wow.
So I was consistently getting altitude training, and that's what I wanted in order to find success in this race. And, you know, I wasn't there alone. I had three roommates in that cabin. An adorable, slightly overweight blue heeler was in that cabin as well. And I got to spend the summer, you know, driving up and down the mountain. You know, I would go down in altitude to different trails, meet other runners, really engage in the community, in the running community as best I could. I did strength training at Alma's Gym, which is the world's highest gym, actually.
Oh, that's
and,
really interesting.
Did my power squats and lunges and got my strength, my mountain legs prepared there. So shout out to Cody at Alma's Gym. And in immersing myself in altitude in mountain running for, you know, the 5 months leading up to this race, I felt super confident getting on that starting line. And I really felt like not only did I think I was a mountain runner, I had all the proof of the summer that I was a mountain runner.
That had to be painful at first, though. The first,
dude,
because when I go back to the gym just here in Minnesota, whether it be a Planet Fitness or a Lifetime or something, and I go back and the first week or two of getting on that stationary bike or that elliptical or whatever the thing is, my legs are telling me, oh, God, dude, you got to quit.
Mm.
But I can only imagine going up to altitude and then doing these strength exercises and then going on runs that are still sort of at altitude. Or So you must have developed quite a tolerance for pain, physical pain for a while.
And maybe I've always had this tolerance for pain, you know, because I wasn't going up to altitude to start this training from, you know, from scratch. I had, you know, years of running experience behind me that really did help my confidence. And then when I, even the first, honestly, like the first month and a half, I didn't do any running. It was all about walking, like walking and hiking and getting my lung capacity and my bloodstream, like everything accustomed to the lower amount of oxygen and resources that I was about, that I was facing. And it really was like these baby step build in my training to get me there.
Let's talk about the race itself.
Yeah.
It's race day. Mm. Take us back to race day.
Mm.
I think I remember reading in your book that it's still dark, right?
Yes. It's a 4 a.m. start.
4 a.m. start. And you know that you're going to be on the road for almost 30 hours.
That's right.
So you're going to see darkness, then light, then more darkness. And so just tell us what it's like to have the hustle and bustle of all those runners at the starting line at 4 a.m., does everybody have their headlight turned on? Are they trying to preserve those and kind of mooch off other headlights so they don't run out of batteries? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, there's a nice mix of all of that. So I walk up So it's a 4 a.m. start, so my alarm was set for 2:30, giving myself about like a solid hour of preparation time in my motel room, which was three or so blocks from the start line. And, you know, I walked from my motel to that start, and you look up, and the sky is just a full smattering of stars everywhere you can look. And then you look ahead toward the start line, and it is a smattering of headlamps everywhere you can look. And there's this very palpable buzz of excitement and eagerness, anticipation. It's this electricity that you just naturally are aware of at the start of anything great, but especially there. And as we, all of us runners, you know, huddled in the corral, we had everyone, you know, who was there to cheer us on at the sidelines, taking video and hollering and hooting. Someone sang the Star Spangled Banner. And you, as someone was singing the Star Spangled Banner, I remember looking up and seeing a shooting star right in the middle of the song.
You can't make that up.
No, and I turned to the gentleman next to me, and he had seen it too, and he said, "Oh, what a good sign." And in that moment, I knew in my bones that I was going to make it to the end of this race. It has a 30-hour cutoff. If you take longer than 30 hours, then you don't get to finish the race, which
no
is
pressure.
Brutal, yeah. Right? But I just knew in that moment, with all that I just had this really deep belief in myself that, yeah, I was going to finish. And then once the Star Spangled Banner was complete, Ken, the race director, you know, draws a shotgun into the air. And in this crystal, quiet, cold mountain morning, he lets the gunshot off. And then we depart. We run through those very tiny bits of pavement in downtown Leadville and then onto a big, dusty Jeep road. That went on for a couple of miles before we actually hit Turquoise Lake, which is a beautiful single-track trail around a lake, and foraging, you know, on for a full day ahead of us.
And what does the first leg of the journey look like? I mean, I imagine there's a few times that you stop for a moment to get refreshments or water, or
sure.
What does that look like? I mean,
yeah.
I know there are particularly spots where you can get first aid, mm-hmm. aid in general, you can get, and you actually had planned to meet up with your partner who was going to hand you off a bag of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much logistics that goes into this and so much support around you.
Yes.
How does that work?
Yeah.
In a nutshell, I guess.
Yeah. So these all big races, they have what are called aid stations, right? So for Leadville particularly, there's your first aid station doesn't arrive until about 12, 13 miles into the race. And that's when the sun is like maybe starting to poke up, depending on where you're at. And I had logistically planned it in such a way that I had everything that I needed in my pack that I could bypass that first aid station and not stop. But the plan was to then stop at the next aid station, which was about, you know, a marathon's distance into the race. This is a much bigger aid station. There's usually, you know, people camp out there. There's a big party going on. And it's easy actually to miss your runner if you're not looking for them.
All of these are coached strategies, right? This
yes.
isn't just, oh, I just don't feel like stopping at that. I'm going to keep going. These are, you really sat down with a coach
yes.
well in advance and planned these moves as part of a greater strategy to get yourself in under 30 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I can 100% say with full confidence that the reason I was able to finish this race was because of my coach, Don Reichelt. So Don, he's an elite ultra runner himself, highly acclaimed, and he helped me formulate not only my training to lead up to this, but the strategy on day of what aid stations was I going to stop at, what food, right, was I going to consume at those aid stations, how much water and electrolytes did I need to make sure that I was consuming, where and how I might need, you know, certain pieces of equipment, like, you know, a fresh headlamp or a change of shoes. So he really helped me strategize well in advance for all that.
Could somebody plausibly do one of these without a coach, or would that just not be...
Sure.
In theory, right?
But. In theory, and you know what? A lot of people do. Ultra running has definitely been booming in the past several years. Access to that has been increasing. Honestly, there are so many people at these aid stations who are ready to help you with resources that you could sign up for one of these races and move through it. And there are plenty of people who will arrive by your side when you need it, truly.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And then another big through line that I wouldn't want to end this interview without hitting on is your relationship with your physical body.
Yes.
And that pops up dating back to childhood, all the way through the training process and the race. And then you actually went back, and I understand you ran it again last summer.
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
So the pain and suffering wasn't enough. You had to go back for some more. And you did it. And under 30 again.
That's right. Yeah, wow. You know, when I was putting this book together, and as I was, you know, thoughtfully piecing what I had, you know, originally posted online and then creating the actual novel or book from it, it was really apparent that, you know, I couldn't tell a story about how I ran 100 miles, trained for and ran the 100 miles without acknowledging my body and what had happened to my body over the years. My interpretation of what had happened to my body and how I have experienced what I'm going to call post-traumatic growth as a result from those experiences. Mm. And there's one chapter in particular in this book that was really painful to write. I put a small paragraph of a trigger warning before this chapter, just as an awareness to my readers before they step into it. But I was given this gift of an opportunity to take note of what it was that past versions of me had experienced, how I had healed or grown from it, and truly the scars that still remain. And it is no secret, if you're part of the ultra running community, that many people who are drawn to ultra running and drawn to these long distances are wounded, you know, in some capacity. Mm-hmm. We're we have stories, we have scars, we have things that we have painfully moved through in our life. And running gives this conduit into a power, a strength, a purpose that really helps to rewrite how we experience our bodies.
Growing up was hard at times. Was it difficult to write about your family of origin? Was it difficult knowing that they were going to read this book? Because we all have challenges in both our upbringing and then our later adult lives, having the best relationships we can with our parents, our siblings. Were you scared to have them read the first draft?
Oh, man. Well, short answer, yes. I think this is one of the major challenges with anyone who partakes, I think, in memoir type of writing, that there are all of these characters from your life that do and, of course, contribute to how you show up in the world and how you experience the world. And this story includes, honestly, like my experience in rejecting the religion that I grew up with, you know, rejecting Catholicism and then making a better understanding for myself on what my spiritual base is and what feels right to me. And one of the painful realities is that, you know, my parents really love their religion and their version of God. And of course they do. but it's painful to see in black and white print your child actively rejecting that. And I think that that was really painful for my parents. I really acknowledge that. And it was indeed scary then to put it out in the world for other people to engage with it and read it. But it felt really necessary for me to do so. And I really tried to have my white gloves on during the process of how can I continue, even though they're part of this experience and I am rejecting their religion, how can I still come at it through the lens of compassion and understanding that they are whole people with all types of influences on why they go through, you know, the world, to see my parents truly as people, right? And not just my parents. So it was a really good exercise for me, but didn't deter me, from publishing it.
And that's some advice I was given in the course of the recovery community recently, is that you can either make good with your parents while they're alive or after. Mm. And that was just struck me as like, what I see you doing is laying down the framework for a really honest relationship with them now. Has anything about this actually improved your connection with them? Because you do write about dad coming out for race day, coming out to Colorado. And he doesn't give you a whole lot of lead time. So you find out, oh, he's coming. And, oh, okay, is this going to be awkward or what? But it sounds like you, in spending time together, spoke your common language, which is a love of nature, a love of the trail, that though his God and your God are different on paper, when you're out in the world, they overlap in a way.
That's right.
And it sounds like the book left me very hopeful about your relationship with your parents, especially your father. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I end the book, again, no spoilers, I suppose, but on the theme of forgiveness, right? And I know, again, I'm not alone in having a complex relationship with a father or figure or father. But I will say this book actually hasn't changed much in my relation, like my actual relationship with my father. And I wasn't necessarily anticipating or expecting that to be the place or to be the case. I was hopeful, and I do still carry that hopefulness with me. But what has happened, or what I can really process and realize now, turning around and looking at this book that I created, was a lot of this book really is like a very honest letter to both of my parents. They have a physical copy of my book. I know that they've read at least parts of it. But we, as a letter writer, you know, you can hope that a person reads and takes you in as your whole self and as compassionate and understanding of your point of view. But we can't of course force that on anyone. So I'm sitting here with some of the sameness, but also some hope too.
You've run one of the most difficult races in the country twice now. You've written this elegant book about it. What's next? Do you feel a sort of like, life is just kind of back to ordinary now? How do you feel now?
Yeah. Well, living in South Minneapolis, life is very far from ordinary right now.
Well, not right now. I didn't mean it. Bigger picture, particular life. But yes, there's a lot of action going on right now, not for the better, of course.
So in what's happening right now in Minneapolis actually is informing this question of what's next for me. I do have a couple of, endurance races on the calendar this year.
Okay, so you're still running. You haven't graduated to becoming just a coach or something.
I mean, I don't know if I will ever stop running. I would love to be that cute little old lady out on the trails who gives you a head nod because she's out there doing her miles, you know, for the day. I am currently recovering from a knee injury, so my running is very light, but it's still there. But it's so funny. I've had people ask me this question of like, Barbara, what's next? And honestly, the New Yorker cartoon comes to mind of there's a butterfly lying on a psychologist's couch and the psychologist is asking the butterfly what's next.
It's
like, the butterfly is like, what do you mean? Like, I've become a butterfly. Like, what do you mean what's next? Like, this is it. And that's kind of what I feel right now of like, I've become this butterfly. This is it. And I think every day is kind of revealing how I can be a positive influence on my community, where I can use my writing for good. And I feel really confident that the next project will indeed reveal itself when it's good in time.
Well, do you want to close today with any more reading from your book?
Yes. Let's see.
It's dealer's choice. It could be poetry. It could be prose. I just want to leave our listeners with one final taste of your writing, which I think is elegant and beautiful and lyrical. It's just so easy to read. I thought it would take me a week on vacation. It took me, you know, I was not even trying, and it just took me a couple days. And then I was like, well, then what? I should have brought another book.
I have gotten that feedback that it is a quick read, which is, it's fun as a writer to hear that. But I think what I'll do is I'll end here with a poem. This is halfway through the book, but it's called Unlearning. The deepest wound I carry is the one titled, You Are Important. I'm trying to hold her, little me, in ways that say, I love you. And you matter here. But unlearned words take so long to make a memory. I keep trying, building a sanctuary unknown to me. I look in the mirror, I squeeze myself tight. I stay at it again and again. I love you, and you matter here. I keep at it, unlearning the unnecessary lessons of unimportance.
That was Barbara Powell, author of Finding Leadville, My Story to a Hallowed 100-Mile Finish Line. Thank you, Barbara, for being here. I really am grateful for the opportunity to talk to you in your home office in Minneapolis. We might have heard a little bit from your pets in the background. We are a pet-friendly radio show.
Good to be here.
Yeah, I hope you'll be willing to come back again sometime, and we'll talk more about the self-publishing process.
I think a lot of
people are curious about that and maybe feel stuck and how they can move forward with their own projects.
Mm. Yeah, if anyone wants to reach out to me directly through my, you know, my socials, ask me any sort of questions around that. I truly am an open book.
And remind us, your Instagram is...
My Instagram is Barbara Powell Coach.
Okay. And they can reach you on a DM or a comment.
That's right. And
go from there.
That's right.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Kirk.
Bye, Barbara.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Write On Radio at 90.3 KFAI FM in the Twin Cities and streaming online at kfai.org. That was host Kirk Klocke in conversation with Minneapolis-based author Barbara Powell. He joined Powell at her home office in Minneapolis to discuss her first book, Finding Leadville, My Story to a Hallowed 100-Mile Finish Line. Today's episode was hosted and produced by Kirk Klocke, with assistance from KFAI staff and volunteers. Special thanks to Barbara Powell. Reach Barbara Powell at Barbara Powell Coach on Instagram. Have ideas or know an author who would like to be on our show? Email us at writeon@kfai.org.
good eye on the